Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from the UK is Jonathan Stern, who's the founder of the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies Natural Gas Research Program and is now its chairman and a senior research fellow. He is honorary professor at the Centre for Energy, Petroleum and Mineral Law and Policy, University of Dundee, visiting professor at Imperial College's Centre for Environmental Policy in London, and a part-time professor at the Moscow School of Management's Energy Centre. Since 2011, he's been the EU speaker for the EU-Russia Gas Advisory Council and is the author of several books, the most recent of which is The Pricing of Internationally Traded Gas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Stern.
Thank you very much indeed.
And I'm trying to figure out here why it is that you need middlemen in the gas pricing, particularly between Russia and Ukraine. There are rumors of war, as you know, and tensions after having taken Crimea. There's a fear that Putin may go further into eastern Ukraine. And there's also reports now that a new gas war between Russia and Ukraine could spark an actual war. So let's start with that question, that puzzlement, if you will. Why these middlemen?
Well, this has a very long history, and it goes right back to the beginning of the post-Soviet period in the early 1990s. And the main reason was that the only way in which Gazprom could get paid by the Ukrainians was to have people located in the Ukraine selling the gas and essentially cutting off people who didn't pay. Now, that has been described by many people as a front for murky and illegal dealings. But nevertheless, when Gazprom tried to operate themselves in the Ukraine, they just ran up a whole load of debt. Whereas these middlemen, the most recent of which is Dmitry Firtash, have always been highly successful at getting paid.
But in terms of Firtash, is being sued in New York by Yulia Tymoshenko, who's running for a former prime minister, who's also running as a presidential candidate. He has been buying about 8 billion cubic meters of Gazprom's gas a year at a price of $95 to $105 lower per 1,000 cubic meters than what Gazprom charges the state energy company, Naftogaz. This costs Gazprom about $800 million annually. So why would a huge gas monopoly like that be willing to lose almost $1 billion a year? And what do they get for that $1 billion?
Well, number one, they get paid. You may recall that part of the problem at the moment is that Gazprom is owed somewhere around $2.7 billion by the state energy company of Ukraine. And that's just the debt up till the beginning of this month. So firstly, they get paid by Firtash. Secondly, Firtash is not supplying residential customers. He's supplying industrial customers who traditionally pay less than residential customers, so their prices are lower. Having said that, I am not suggesting that there is not some inconsistency or dubious dealings between Firtash, the Ukrainian state, and Gazprom. There have been many, many allegations over a long period of time. What's interesting is that no one's ever been able to prove anything about this. So these allegations remain just that, allegations strenuously denied by his lawyers.
Well, of course, we also have something along the lines of the pot calling the kettle black, do we not, with Yulia Tymoshenko, the former Ukrainian prime minister and now presidential candidate, who's suing Firtash in New York courts. She has a nickname, does she not, as the gas princess, having made a fortune with the United Energy Systems of Ukraine. So I take it Diogenes would have a hard time finding an honest person in this milieu.
I think that's very well put. What we have seen over the 20 years of post-Soviet Ukraine is that the leaderships and the oligarchs which support the leaders in Ukraine have had large dealings in the gas business, and we believe have made very, very large amounts of money from those dealings.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Stone, who's the founder of Oxford Institutes for Energy Studies Natural Gas Research Program and is now its chairman and senior research fellow. He is honorary professor at the Center for Energy, Petroleum and Mineral Law and Policy at the University of Dundee, visiting professor at Imperial College's Center for Environmental Policy in London, and a part-time professor at Moscow School of Management's Energy Center. Since 2011, he has been the EU speaker for the EU-Russia Gas Advisory Council and is the author of several books, the most recent of which is The Pricing of Internationally Traded Gas. So how do we explain, though, this sort of overnight millionaire or billionaire, this 27-year-old gas trader from Ukraine that nobody had heard of until Forbes wrote about him, and he's a young billionaire, Sergei Kachenko. He was so offended by the article in Forbes that he actually bought the publication and hired a new editor. And now he's wanted for evading customs and his whereabouts are unknown. So give us a sense of how you could get that rich that quick.
You know, this is very difficult to know because we do not know the beneficiaries behind these gas deals. And as I mentioned, there are all kinds of allegations that Russian politicians, Ukrainian politicians, Gazprom management are the ultimate beneficiaries behind these middlemen. But nothing has ever been proved. And it's very difficult to know how these guys got so rich so quickly. On the other hand, you don't want to be throwing around allegations that you can't back up because you will very quickly hear from their lawyers.
So at this point, what's your sense then of this standoff over Russian gas, where the Ukrainians are balking and resisting the idea that they have to pay, I think, almost double what they paid before? You mentioned there already is a huge debt in any case. And the last time around, when the Russians turned off the tap, the Ukrainians just stole gas that was and diverted it that was supposed to go to the rest of Europe. So
that's exactly right. And that has been the story of the post-Soviet period. And it's been the reason why the Russians have been reluctant and indeed in many cases unable to install payment discipline in Ukraine. However, starting in the late 2000s, they began to build alternative pipelines. They now have a significant amount, not a complete amount, but a significant amount of alternative pipeline capacity serving Europe. But the real problem that we face is there is already a huge debt. At the beginning of this month, $2.7 billion, probably closer to $3 billion now. Then the issue is, what should the price be starting at the beginning of this month? Now, the Ukrainian side has not disputed the debt. What they have said is, unless you, Vladimir Putin, reduce the price to what we were paying up till April, we're not going to pay you any money. I think that is an unsupportable position. For me, they have to pay the money they owe, since they agree they owe it. Then there's a question of what price should they pay starting at the beginning of April. And that is a contractually complex subject. It involves the original contract signed in January 2009, which runs until 2019, and then two additional agreements, one signed with former President Yanukovych back in December, and another one signed in April 2010, which involves the Black Sea Fleet base at Sebastopol in Crimea.
Well, would there be any quid pro quo that the Ukrainians could ask for, given that they've just been humiliated losing Crimea? They can't go to the Russians and say, well, you've just gotten Crimea. It's worth X billions of dollars. Give us a break.
Well, actually, I think there's a potential for that to happen in this sense. This is a contractual dispute, so it's not about what anybody thinks, something to do with Russian actions in Crimea. It's about what the contract says. In my view, the contract will say, I'm not a contract lawyer, but in my view, the contract will say, you have to pay the price that was under the contract, but when Russian side signed that agreement in April 2010, and it signed it for, it's a 25-year agreement. It did not say, and if Russians take over the Crimea, that discount disappears. And in my view, I think an arbitral tribunal, which is where it will go to Stockholm to the arbitral tribunal. I think the tribunal may say to the Russian side, well, if you thought you were going to take over the Crimea, then you probably shouldn't have signed this. You did sign it, and we believe that discount should stand. It's a difficult call, but I think the Ukrainians could have a very good argument there. Where I think they don't have a good argument is the agreement signed between President Putin and Yanukovych back in December, which essentially said, if you pay on time, you can have a $100 discount. Well, they haven't paid on time, so they can't have that discount.
So in the broader sense, then, Jonathan Stern, the backlash to what Putin is doing so far apparently is quite palpable in the, particularly in the Baltic states. They're quite concerned, and it may end up strengthening NATO against Russia as opposed to NATO being something somewhat moribund. There is a different kind of reaction in Belarus, where the Lukashenko, the sort of Stalinist relic there, he's basically saying to his people, see, this, you know, we don't want to be like Ukraine. We don't want that instability. I provide you with stability. So those seem to be the forces unleashed in geopolitics. But the bigger issue is the economy and whether Putin's victories, in territorially speaking, will be offset by economic sanctions and the possibility that he may stimulate the Western Europeans to find alternatives to Russian energy over the long term. And there's talk about liquid natural gas plants being built, etc. It'll take a while. But what's your analysis of the broader repercussions to Putin's actions?
Well, my view, which I've tried to express to all media outlets, is we have a political crisis with the Russians. Let's not turn that into an energy crisis. The political arguments about Crimea and how Putin has behaved and is behaving in eastern Ukraine are a political crisis, and that's the level we should deal with them on. If Europeans think that they can replace Russian energy with other forms of energy, that's fine. As you said, it is a very long-term prospect. This has been under discussion for the whole of the post-Soviet period, and very little progress has been made. In fact, you will find that Europeans are more dependent on Russian energy in 2014 than they were in the early 1990s in the immediate post-Soviet period. So these are not new ideas that the Europeans could replace Russian energy. They haven't done it, and particularly in relation to gas, it would take at least 10 years to make any serious dent in dependence on Russia, not to speak of the long-term contracts that many countries have, which means that they are contractually obliged to take this gas from Russia.
But I don't know how, Jonathan, you can separate the politics from energy or economics, given that the US and the EU have so few points of leverage against Putin. They only seem to have the threat of economic sanctions. There's certainly no talk of military intervention. So wouldn't, if Putin goes further in Ukraine, wouldn't that force the Europeans and the United States to, deepen the sanctions?
I think it would, but I don't think that necessarily has to involve energy directly. What we've seen in relation to, for example, Iran, is very effective economic sanctions in relation to finance. So I think there are many options that they can take there. What I would say, and this is very important for people in the US to understand, is the US has no skin in this game. The US is not going to be hurt by anything that sanctions may occasion in Russia. Europe has a huge amount of skin here. There are multi-billions of euros of deals here. So Europe has to think very, very carefully before it decides to incur those costs for itself if it applies sanctions, which isn't to say it shouldn't do it. It's to say that it's much easier for the US to talk and consider this than it is for Europeans.
So that might explain in some of the US criticism of Europe. And I don't know whether you recall that intercepted phone conversation with a State Department official and the US ambassador castigating the Europeans for being feckless in not showing sufficient support for the revolution, or if that's what we call it, that just took place in Ukraine. Is that what's going on here? Is that the U.S. simply doesn't have an understanding of how deep these economic ties are? And
I think it's partly that. The U.S. has no kind of relations like this almost in the world. So the U.S. is, especially with shale gas, is become virtually an independent actor as far as energy is concerned, and doesn't really understand the depth of these ties and the amount of money that's involved in them. But secondly, I think, as far as I understand the U.S. reaction to the Ukrainian situation, it doesn't have the misgivings that many people in Europe do about the provisional government in Ukraine and many of the complaints being voiced by the Russians, which are not to the same extent as Putin is suggesting, but there is very definite nervousness about some of the people who are in the provisional government and their views, particularly, you know, some of the rightist factions. There's very considerable concern in some European capitals about these people. And I think that there's a feeling that, well, look, let's have the presidential elections next month and then see where we are before we talk about taking very substantial sanctions moves which could incur very considerable costs for us.
Well, apparently, though, these elections, given that these right-wing people that you're referring to in this new Ukrainian government, whose numbers in the cabinet do outweigh their electoral support, since their electoral support is so low, presumably if there is an election on May the 25th, there will be much fewer of these right sector people in the government. That's reasonable to assume, isn't it?
Well, I don't have a sense of how much support these people have on the ground or whether their support has increased or decreased with the events of the last 4 or 5 weeks. So it's very difficult to say that. But, I mean, you shouldn't underestimate the nervousness that some European politicians have in wholehearted support for this provisional Ukrainian government. I think people here would feel very much more confident of saying, well, look, let's have an election, let's see who wins that election, and then let's move on from there. Because it could very well be that the people in charge after the election are very different to the people who are currently the spokesman for the government in Kiev.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jonathan Stern. I appreciate it.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Stern, who's the founder of the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies Natural Gas Research Program and is now its chairman and senior research fellow. He is an honorary professor at the Centre for Energy, Petroleum and Mineral Law and Policy at the University of Dundee, visiting professor at Imperial College's Centre for Environmental Policy in London, and a part-time professor at the Moscow School of Management's Energy Centre. Since 2011, he's been the EU speaker for the EU-Russia Gas Advisory Council and is the author of several books, the most recent of which is The Pricing of International Traded Gas. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the just discovered Goldilocks planet that's not too hot and not too cold.